and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, the specter of recession. And Richard, over the past few weeks or so, really the last week, the anxiety about whether or not the country maybe headed for recession has stepped up. It's been there for a while, but then we saw the yield curve invert, and that's a famously strong, though not perfect, predictor of a coming recession. I'm not going to ask you to read the tea leaves on that today, but I am going to ask you to parse some of the derivative arguments about economic policy that are occurring because of the prospect of recession. And I'll start you with monetary policy. President Trump has been very hard on Jerome Powell, the man he appointed to chair the Fed, for setting interest rates too high. Just this morning, the president tweeted about Powell. I'm gonna quote this for you, Richard. Brace yourself. He's like a golfer who can't putt, has no touch. Big U.S. growth if he does the right thing, which the president puts in all caps, big cut. But don't count on him. So far, he's called it wrong and only let us down, close quote. So there are a couple of issues there, obviously. One is how the president has conducted himself vis-a-vis the Fed, which is supposed to be operationally independent. But let me have you start with the core policy critique, that Powell ought to be aggressively cutting rates in order to keep the economy strong. What's your response to that?
Well, I think it's a terrible idea on the part of the president, because trying to run the monetary system is not like trying to play a game of golf. And what happens is the level of discretion that you introduce in order to have the Fed do something that you might like is the same level of discretion that you introduce when the Fed is going to do absolutely something crazy. Every time you have major interest cuts and the restoration of those things, what you've done is you've added another element of uncertainty into the economy. And this is extremely important because it means that every long and short-term transaction, which is denominated in dollars, has another risk associated with it, given the value of the currency domestically in relation to foreign currencies, in relationships to yield and everything else. I'm still with Milton Friedman on this one. You may not want a gold standard, but essentially what you would like to do is to have a standard in which the sole function of the Fed is not to figure out intuitively what the rates ought to be in response to a president or anybody else, but to figure out some objective standard based upon money supply or interest rates or something of the sort, and then make predictable corrections by machine that essentially get rid of the individual kind of discretion. So I think he's got that wrong. The second point that he gets this wrong is it is just madness under these circumstances to assume that if you made a large cut, that things would start to turn positive instead of negative. What the president seems to forget is what happens is if you decide that you're going to cut interest rates, people are going to be more willing to borrow. And that means that you're going to get some kind of an expansion. But on the other hand, if you cut interest rates, it means that people are going to be less willing to lend. So this offsetting effect cannot be ignored. If you cut interest rates and you have lots of people who are sitting there essentially in a cash-rich position, who are retirees or something of the sort, they get lower income. That means that their expenditures for consumption are going to go up or down. There's a basic rule about all of this stuff, which he seems to forget, is that any interest rate alteration is a transfer of wealth from one side to the other side, and you have to bet that the gains on one side are better than the losses on the other side, and it's extremely difficult to do that with respect to monetary policy. So given all of these offsetting effects, it seems to me that he's wrong there. The third thing, of course, is every time you get a president who thinks that it's appropriate to bully, that itself is another independent element of uncertainty, because the man who will bully the Fed is the man who will bully Harley Davidson or General Motors or somebody else, and people are going to start to make sure that they hedge their bets in the business market for fear of attracting his particular wrath. So on this particular issue, Donald Trump essentially, as I think, is way off base. And the great tragedy is, lunatic as he is the voice of sanity compared to what most of the Democrats want to do on most of these issues. And he is seriously compromising his chance of being reelected. He's becoming erratic. He's becoming uncertain. He's becoming self-righteous. And he makes himself sound completely uninformed.
Of course, another factor that we've got to talk about here is trade. The president recently announced that he's going to be escalating the tariffs against China. And interestingly, given that he spent most of his time recently trying to dismiss the possibility of a recession, the president actually said yesterday that even if we did fall into a recession, he was suggesting it'd be a short one, it'd be worth it because someone had to take on China. Now, that is implicitly closer to the non-maximalist defense you hear of the China policy sometimes, which doesn't embrace the president's idea that we're profiting off the tariffs. It recognizes the economic consequences, but says the real goal here is strategic, and it's worth absorbing some of that economic cost in order to bring Beijing to heel. Do you have any sympathy for that point of view?
I have no sympathy whatsoever for any point of view that takes that line. But let's start with the beginning about China. And there was a nice column in the Wall Street Journal this morning by Mitch McConnell that said these people are essentially evil in the way in which they suppress civil liberties, dissent, put people into forced camps, and so forth. I wish that had come more explicitly from the president. And there is no question that these human rights violations, which I regard as massive and inexcusable, do perhaps call for some kind of a response. But what's the kind of response that it calls for is probably diplomatic. It's probably collected with other individuals. It's probably trying to show some degree of support and solidarity with respect to Hong Kong and a whole variety of things. The trade stuff has the following situation. As I mentioned to you, the rate shifts that you could have are win on one side, loss on another side. It's a transfer payment with an offset. The trade stuff is just a dead loss. We hurt China and we hurt ourselves because their gains from trade, which are blocked by this transaction. Both sides will try to minimize the gains by cutting back on their resource commitments, by trying to find alternative sources of goods to sell or to buy and so forth. But by definition, these are all second best alternatives because the market was already there. There's no way that you can stop this. And if there's going to be a recession, it's going to be in large part because the president has decided to push very hard on the trade lever. Now, he says, I could always make offsets. This is the case of a man who understands so little that he's always trying to do something which is too clever by half. So he says, I'll help the farmers. I'll give them a transfer payment. Well, the transfer payment is about one-fourth of what they've lost or even less than that. It comes out of somebody else where it's a tax. You destroy the American markets that have been developed over the years in China, and you have absolutely nothing to show for it. So what happens is he has to basically essentially come to the following conclusion. China is a bad actor in two ways. It has intolerable forms of human rights violations and external aggression. And it also turns out to be a long-term snitch, spy, and thief of intellectual property. Target the things that are bad, but don't expand the war to go out to something else. And so what is so ironic is when he goes after the Fed, it's a very difficult calculation to make. When it comes to the thing that he wants to do, that is to have the recession through the trade stuff, it's an easy calculation. It's lose-lose all around. I mean, I just wish that he had had a decent course in first-year economics or had been sober enough to start to attend to it. But he's still in the influence of Wilbur Ross and Peter Navarro. And on this score, his behavior is, again, a very, very weak performance indeed.
One of the ideas that we've seen come out of the White House in the past few days in reaction to this economic anxiety is the suggestion that maybe there could be a payroll tax cut. Now, this is something that the Obama administration did at one point, too. And the argument here is that payroll tax cuts have a wider effect because there are a lot of people who pay payroll taxes but don't pay conventional income taxes. But this is a type of tax cut that many conservatives are actually somewhat skeptical of. What's your view on the utility of cutting payroll taxes?
Well, in general, I think cutting a payroll tax is probably a good idea, but it's completely unrelated to anything that has to do with the recession. Probably the tax which has the least impact on economic activity is a flat tax on income against or from all sources and all parties. Payroll tax is essentially an exchange tax. And when you put this tax on, it's a little bit like changing the interest rates, rather like the trade stuff. You're going to have fewer transactions. Just think of it this way. If the payroll tax were 100%, there'd be no jobs in the United States. So yes, I want to cut it, and I want the revenues to come from somewhere else. Or more importantly, I want to make sure that we cut the spending along with this. But the president is, again, barking up the wrong tree. The radio reports today announced that we're heading for a $1 trillion deficit. And, you know, this is a conspiracy to which many parties must plead guilty. The president is certainly not tight when it comes to expenditures. The Democrats are positively promiscuous when it comes to spending other people's money. And so if you're really trying to figure out what's going on, that huge hurricane, you know, overhang of a deficit may yet become an important element in some of these kinds of cases. So I think what the president needs to do is to recognize as follows: the size of the financial resource base in the United States that is spent through public means is too large. He has to cut that back. He has generally failed to do that. And so he's kind of like a populist Republican, half Democrat on that. And that's where he ought to concentrate his power. But he is not one who really goes after subsidies. The president, essentially, everything he does is based upon how the world looks when it affected him in business. So he doesn't like foreign trade because he doesn't like foreign competition for his hotel. And he doesn't like local regulations because they slow down the business in his particular kind of hotel. And so it's always the same kind of thing. What does it do to Donald? And once he figures that out, then he assumes that his position is that of the just society, and he always wants to enforce it in the same way. I mean, it is really frightening to have somebody so ignorant put in charge of such issues of immense importance, knowing that for all of his blunders, the Democrats are probably worse. And it is very instructive, Troy, if you go back to some of these discussions, particularly on trade, I have not heard a single peep coming from the Democrats with respect to the tariff wars that he has with China. Have you? To ask the question of my beloved moderator.
No, not much. Not much. And of course, we had in the run-up to the 2016 election, you had Democrats who were in favor of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, notably Hillary Clinton, who then changed their position in the course of the campaign.
Well, what she found out was, I mean, I remember having a wonderful discussion about this with a man named Matt Gold, who knows this stuff inside and out, is she was, quote, a closet free trader, but it played so badly everywhere that if you try to run on that campaign plaque, you're going to fail. This is a huge condemnation of the American public for systematic ignorance on a matter of great importance. And let me just do to give you the simple version of the fallacy. A job disappears to China or to Mexico or to somewhere else. And somebody says, aha, if there were no trade, these jobs would still be here. That's wrong. What would happen is the people who decided to export the jobs to somewhere else would then try to figure out how it is that they minimize their current losses. And if the current environment is weak, they will downsize, they will shut their business, they will move to another state. But the thought that if you take out the free trade option, everybody who's really hurting under the current regulatory system is going to stay pat is absurd. And so what you have to do is to explain to people the only way that you can cure the free trade difficulty is not by blocking options that companies want to take. It's by making your own home base more attractive for people so that you'll keep the investment that's already there and attract some other. I could recall a speech that Nikki Haley, somebody whom I greatly admire, gave at the FedSoc a couple of years ago, and she says that was what we tried in South Carolina. We didn't start, you know, baying at the wind. What we try to do is to make the place a little bit more attractive and hope that we could get that next Michelin plant there. And she largely succeeded in those efforts. And that's what you have to do. You have to make yourself more competitive. It does not work in this world to try to make your competitors less competitive. What happens then is both of you lose.
So the final question that I'll put to you, we can step back from the politics of the moment for a second and think about recessions as a concept, because over time, we've gotten more and more comfortable with the idea that the second you start talking recessions, as we are now, you have to start talking about stimulus, about ways to essentially counter the drift of the economy. There is a school of thought, however, that thinks of recessions as necessary correctives. This is sort of the wildfire theory of recessions, that they purge the economy of a lot of inefficient actors and lay the predicate for new growth. Is that view appealing to you?
It has some modest appeal. That was the position that was taken early on in the Harding administration, where with respect to the recession that they inherited after Wilson, what they did is they kept a very tight money policy, 6-7% interest. And by the time you got to 1921, things were starting to boom much more, precisely because a lot of the dead wood had been swept away. But if you recall my answer to the first question, I'm very skeptical about the ability to start to use monetary policy, fiscal policy, any kind of policy, to try to regulate what the economy is, given the fact that the uncertainties are a systematic loss and you have zero confidence that any particular government is going to make the right move at the right time. And so when you start hearing a talk about the stimulus, it's going to be a mistake. Let me give you one example. Back in March of 2008, I think it was, that George Bush said, I'm going to give a stimulus program. And the first stimulus program was, I think, $500 per family, either below a certain level of income or maybe even generally. And the theory is, we give them $500. They're going to spend $500 and we'll stimulate growth through consumption. But of course, that's not the way people work. The $500 that came in was an exogenous shock. It was a lump sum payment. It was not a recurrent expenditure. And so some people said, well, I now got an increase in capital. And how did they allocate it? Well, some people put it to savings for their children for college. Some people use it to pay off past payroll debts and so forth. And a few people use it to make sort of additional purchases. But the thought that somehow or other, if you give people some kind of money, it's going to dictate the way in which they spend it in a way that you hope is just a failure. And what makes it even worse is that sometimes you start giving the stimulus and then you say, ah, now what we really have to do since we've given this stimulus is also have a regulatory component. And so when they had the stimulus program with the ARRA statute in early Obama years about the various kinds of relief, sure enough, we have a little bit of a stimulus. And then what we decide to do is to subsidize unions by giving them strong protection against competition and so forth. So the stimulus program almost never comes as an isolated event. It becomes basically very much tied to other kinds of things. And, you know, I'm a laissez-faire guy, and I don't regard myself as naive, but I think, in effect, that what the purpose of government policy is to create stability in which various kinds of shocks, essentially, will necessarily lead to losses, even if they, to some extent, some of the time may work in the right direction. And so you want to pre-program this particular element. And essentially, the great conceit of the modern times, and I think this is a kind of Hayekian motion, is all the people who are starting to talk for a stimulus, they don't tell you to whom, they don't tell you how much, they don't tell you for how long. They're all too clever by half. And, you know, I wrote a book called Simple Rules for a Complex World. And basically, if you don't engage in all the stupidities that get you into this kind of a recession, you won't have to engage in all the sort of ingenious half measures, half-baked measures to try to get you out of it. These are all losing propositions. The Republicans don't seem to have much spine on this particular situation. The Democrats, I think, are already in the wrong side of this thing. And I see no sign whatsoever that there's a real support for competitive markets and social equilibrium of that particular sort on either side of the political fence. And that's why Donald Trump isn't so destructive. He should be a market guy, but he's a naked populist.
All right. Thank you, Richard. And thank you to our listeners. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column, The Libertarian, by visiting DefiningIdeas at hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on your favorite podcasting service. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.